You're listening to TIP.
On today's episode, we have Chief Investment Officer of Family Management Corporation, David Shaw. Family Management currently has close to $3 billion in assets under management, and David oversees the allocation across a wide array of assets. For this reason, we had a very holistic conversation covering everything from what it was like to begin his career right as the global financial crisis began, his stance on the banking sector in today's environment, the most surprising metric of 2021 to date, and be sure to stick around towards the end where David offers a few stock selections that he's currently bullish on. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging discussion with David Shaw.
You are listening to The Investor's Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
Welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Trey Lockerbie, and today we have with us David Shaw. First time on the show. Thanks a lot for coming on, David.
Thank you for having me.
One thing that I thought we could cover right here at the top would be your experience working for a company called Square One Financial, because as I understand it, you were more or less thrown into the pit when the global financial crisis was just starting to happen, and you somehow climbed your way out. And I just love to hear that story and what you learned from that time.
So it was early 2008, and I had spent a few years working on Wall Street in sell side research. And my wife and I decided to come back to North Carolina. Obviously, we didn't know the financial crisis was upon us. And I joined a de novo bank called Square One Financial. And the easiest way to think about it is we were very similar to Silicon Valley Bank in that we were a bank that lent to venture-backed companies and the VCs themselves. And so I started in what they called the analyst training program, which was to be a credit analyst. So I would underwrite new credits. So let's say a company gets $20 million equity round from a VC, and then we might provide them with $3 or $4 million line of credit or term loan. So I thought that's what I was going to do. And one day the CEO came to my desk and said, you know, hey, David, I heard you worked on Wall Street. We're having some problems with our investment portfolio and we'd like some help. And so long story short, and this is the bank's own investment. So basically the deposits that are not lent out, we would invest into the bond market. But the bank had been saddled with a lot of subprime and Alt-A mortgage-backed securities that were bought by their outsourced manager. And so I told the CEO, his name is Richard, I said, Richard, you know, I'm happy to help you out, but I don't know anything about fixed income or credit, let alone mortgage-backed securities. And he said, well, that's okay. You know, we need your help. So basically, the bank had about $500 million of bonds that were going bad. And kind of every day they were, you know, falling in value. And to think about what was in them, you know, it was very similar to what you saw in the movie, The Big Short. You know, I remember looking at one bond and the bond was only about 6 months old. And it was already 30% of the borrowers in that pool had not made one single payment on their mortgage. So kind of pulling back, you know, the covers and, you know, looking under the hood of these bonds and looking at a loan by loan analysis, it was kind of remarkable and frightening to see just how poor a lot of underlying credits were at this time. So I really had to, you know, self-teach myself.
How old were you when this happened?
I was only 3 years out of undergraduate.
Yeah, so early 20s.
Yeah. It was interesting because nobody really knew what was going on at the time. And everything was unraveling. And I think people didn't know at the time how bad it was going to be. And so I really had to dig in. You know, I started reading prospectuses and modeling cash flows and having to meet with the regulators that came in, the Fed and FDIC and so forth. And, you know, they surely didn't know what was going on. So it was really quite an interesting environment of having to learn in the biggest financial crisis, you know, the country had seen, you know, since the Great Depression. So it was quite the introduction to credit and fixed income in general.
The way you described your boss, Richard, telling you that they were having some problems, He sounded so casual in your delivery there that I found it humorous. I was envisioning like the boss from Office Space with a coffee mug just being like, hey, David, we're having some issues here.
And I think that there was hope, you know, that, you know, things would turn around. But, you know, I felt like the more, you know, you peeled back the onion and the more you saw, you know, the more you realized that, you know, these were going to be very problematic. And the way that a lot of these mortgage-backed securities are structured is there's different tranches and subordination. So a lot of the bonds were, if you sat in the senior part of the capital structure, you know, they might have been okay, even if, you know, many of the underlying loans were bad. If you sat in more mezzanine and junior positions, you know, you could be wiped out, let's say if 20 or 30% of the loans went bad and started to take losses. So it wasn't just the underlying credit, but where you sat in the capital structure. And basically going back to that environment is you would get paid, let's say, another 10 or 15 or 20 basis points to assume a lower tranche in the structure of these bonds. And so, you know, they got paid in hindsight what was a very meager additional interest stream just to take on incremental credit risk. But you know, the bank ended up raising additional capital. We made it through, and, you know, I continued to manage the portfolio for Square One, which was kind of, you know, the kitchen sink of credit, whether it was mortgages, investment-grade corporate bonds, municipal bonds, preferred stock, some high-yield bonds, and kind of everything in between. So it was kind of an interesting foray into the credit markets.
You mentioned some of the clients not paying their mortgage. My understanding was a big impetus for that crash was not only CDOs, but essentially these variable interest rates that were attached to these mortgages where there was sometimes sort of, I think even a zero interest rate for a number of years, and then it would pop, right, to 5 or 6%. And that's when a lot of families ran into trouble. They maybe expected to have more income by that time and didn't, and then they started falling short. When you were starting to dig into loan by loan, et cetera, of what was going bad, is that the main takeaway that you saw happening?
Well, there was certainly some of that. There was a lot of different programs. And I think, you know, just for the listeners to highlight kind of what was happening, if you go back to the pre-financial crisis, over half of the mortgages being originated were what you'd call non-agency mortgages. And basically what that means is that those mortgages did not have the backing of the GSEs, meaning Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie Mae. They were not government backed. And if you go to today, it's kind of all the way at the other end of the spectrum, being almost probably 95% government back, and the private, you know, the non-agency market is a pretty small sliver of the overall market. But at that point in time, pre-crisis, you know, there was a lot of creative programs that were put into practice to get that affordability down, to get those teaser rates. And there was a number of different programs that would get. So the underwriting and, you know, the fact that, you know, more than half the originations were outside of the GSEs, you know, really led to a lot of creativity and, unfortunately, poor underwriting, and that led to a lot of the problems.
So you've moved on from working at a bank, but the banking sector is interesting in a lot of ways, somewhat appealing and somewhat not, given obviously the interest rates are still very low. But then you have the fact that you're basically backstopped by the Fed, and you're able to sell your bonds with a top bidder. And I'm curious, like, what is your general take on the financial sector in today's environment?
Well, the financial sector as a whole, you know, there's kind of a good and bad to it. So, you know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, the Fed has embarked on kind of unprecedented monetary policy, Fed funds being very low, and there's a lot of facilities out there that banks can borrow from, you know, whether it's the discount window overnight to Fed or a lot of other programs that they've come out with since. So I think from a funding perspective, from a borrowing perspective, it's a lot easier. But, you know, obviously the problem right now is that to find earning assets at any type of yield is a lot more challenging. So I think that the banking sector is fairly low risk right now, in that capital ratios are pretty high. Banks have a lot of sources of liquidity and funding. the regulators are a lot stricter on what types of loans can be originated. And I think the asset quality is pretty good. And I think a lot of the risk in lending has kind of moved out of the regulated banking sector and kind of more to the non-bank shadow banking segment.
With that, I'd like to kind of fast forward now to today, or at least 2021, because what you were just saying is, you know, obviously asset prices are at high levels, highest all-time highs. What was your playbook going into 2021? Because obviously things were high even at the end of 2020. I'm curious, how are you approaching 2021 and how has it potentially changed, if at all?
If you went back to the end of last year, you know, the 10-year treasury was at 92 basis points. We had not had the Georgia runoffs yet. And I think there was a lot of uncertainty just as far as who is going to control Congress. You know, and at that point, you know, what type of fiscal spending would come to be. So coming into there, interest rates were pretty low. I think the general consensus on the street was that we'd probably have a split Congress. The Republicans would probably keep control of the Senate and the Democrats would have the House. And maybe President Biden could get through some things, but probably not aggressively. And I think that playbook kind of changed once the Dems swept the runoff in January. And you start to see a lot of the cyclicals rally. Interest rates started to pop. So, you know, they went from, I think, the end of September last year, 10-year at 65 basis points, to they peaked at just about 175 at the end of March last year, or this year, rather. So it was, you know, over 100 basis point rise and really rotation into cyclicals. So I think the speed at which that happened was probably a little bit surprising for a lot of market participants, but we had also been, the market had not been accustomed to a scenario where you had not only monetary policy being easy, but also fiscal spending. You know, obviously during the COVID pandemic, you know, there was the emergency spending and PPP and different types of stimulus. But obviously since then, they've also enacted other programs. So the type of fiscal spending to plug the demand gap, you know, that happened as the economy went to a standstill, you know, something we really haven't seen before. So I think, you know, the combination of all that and the additional spending really, you know, gave a lot of fuel to the market and for a while led to a pretty big rotation and, you know, interest rates going up, cyclicals rallying and, you know, kind of a change in market leadership, which probably lasted until May and early June when, you know, I think the Delta variant fears came back and interest rates have kind of given back some of their gains in yield since then.
The S&P 500 is up a little over 20% year to date. Russell's up 16. NASDAQ's up 21. Just year to date. And this is at the time of recording, obviously, which is early September. What is the indicator that has recently made you sit back in your chair and just say, wow, you know, given where you maybe thought we'd be at this point last year and what has transpired, is there anything, any metric that stood out to you that's, you know, kind of blown your hair back a little bit?
No, it's a fair question. I think the thing that's been most amazing this year has been the revision in earnings for the market. So if you think about coming into the year, I think the consensus for the S&P earnings for 2021 was probably around $160 per share. And typically, economists and sell side is pretty optimistic on that. But in this case, you know, the market has dramatically underestimated just how much the S&P would earn this year. And now fast forward to, as you said, we're in early September, you know, the market is assuming that the S&P can earn north of $200 per share. So really, you know, there's been a significant push upward in earnings estimates. And I think it's worth looking into why that's happened. Your next question is probably going to be, well, why have earnings come in so much higher than expectations? And so and particularly with all the headlines about rising costs, input costs are going up, you know, and whether that's transitory or permanent, you know, yet to be seen. Labor costs are going up. So how in the world have S&P earnings gone up this much? And I think the answer is twofold. One, top line growth has really exploded. Revenue growth has really gone up far higher than people thought. And then the second thing is, I think on a cost structure, going into COVID last year, I think a lot of firms really right-sized their business, you know, maybe cut back on different types of expenses that they didn't feel like were, you know, necessary, and maybe probably prepared for an environment where times were probably going to be rough. And I think that seemed pretty reasonable to think, you know, in a pandemic that companies would have to cut their cost structure. And I think what's happened is revenues exploded and the cost structures have gone up, but not nearly as much as revenues have. And therefore, we're really at record operating margins. So profit margins are now at record highs despite all of the stuff happening. And so I think most market participants, unless you're looking at these type of things day by day, are not realizing that this has really been an earnings-driven year. I think most people would probably think earnings, you know, maybe they're up a little bit, but maybe the multiple on the market has skyrocketed, but it's not really been the case. You know, earnings have really driven, I think, the bulk of this year's gains.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn, on average, 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at Vacasa.com. That's Vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
I might postulate one third factor, which is related to what you said, I think. But if you're looking at the S&P 500, you know, 25% of it is the FANG stocks, essentially, right? And so those companies get even more operational leverage because they don't have a lot of I don't know if I phrase this right, but it's not like their cost of goods is actually physical. It's usually software based. And when everything went online during the pandemic, more or less, I mean, there's this huge gold rush onto Amazon and other platforms because retailers were closed. Do you think that those companies having already high margins that got even higher is playing a big factor into the aggregate of the S&P?
If you look at the free cash flow margins and, you know, all sorts of profitability metrics on mega cap tech, just head and shoulders above the rest of the market from a profitability perspective. And, you know, going back decades, kind of the rest of the market is trading at very similar profit margins. And it's really been, as you're alluding to, S&P being a market cap driven index, it's really been a lot of those mega cap technology companies that have driven a lot of the growth and profitability and earnings.
You mentioned that there was a lot of liquidity out there that was piling into the market. I'm curious if you follow how much money is still sitting on the sidelines, given that we've already seen such a huge run up. Are you seeing money still on the sidelines that could potentially enter the market?
Well, that phrase is kind of controversial, and I guess there's a lot of semantics with the whole cash on the sidelines thing, so not going down that rabbit hole. But I think to answer that question a different way, I think a lot of market participants really feel like equities are the only game in town, especially with interest rates so low. And on a real basis, after accounting for inflation, you know, yields are negative. You know, treasury yields are negative on a real basis. So I feel like, you know, a lot of participants feel like the equities really are, you know, one of the only games in town, and that, you know, sure, they've got a lot of embedded gains, but really, where else are they going to realistically put this money if they sell? So I think from that perspective, I think that a lot of participants and investors might feel like things are expensive, but they're also going to tell you that they don't feel like there's a lot of good places to go otherwise.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I was thinking about your clients, right? Being that you're an advisory, what's the sentiment of your client base? Is it very risk on, or is it becoming more risk off as prices have gotten higher?
Well, I think to take a step back, I think obviously every client's situation is different, and we have to account for that. I think the other thing to think about is we try to set up client portfolios to be resilient during a multitude of scenarios. So for instance, we're not going to try to set up an allocation to win under one or two outcomes and lose heavily under others. So I think I always like to say we try to be approximately right. We'd rather be approximately right than precisely wrong. That being said, I think, you know, your question is clients certainly are surprised that the markets continue to run and where we are. And, you know, to think back where we've been a year and a half ago, it's pretty amazing to see. But I think, you know, our goal is to try not to predict the near term, but set up portfolios to be resilient for a lot of different outcomes, because, you know, the smartest minds in the market, and I'm certainly not one of them, don't know what's going to happen, right? And so it's really, you know, I try to think about it being, you know, more of a scenario analysis. How do we structure portfolios if the market ends up running 2 years longer than people think, versus we really do see mean reversion and different things and broad asset prices fall down? So it's really a balance between that, and then also handling the psychological profile of each client, because a lot of investing is really not, you know, really it's not making bad decisions at the wrong time. So you can really, you just need to not make poor decisions a couple times a year. And if you can avoid doing that, then historically you've been good. So there's certainly a psychological component to not only when asset prices are high, but also when they're low and falling.
I think that's very wise. I am reminded of, you know, something Howard Marks just said on our show, which was that they were essentially moving ahead, but with caution. And that resonates with me, because I would have told you probably back in 2015 that the market was pretty overvalued. I mean, it's just, who's to say? It's been running for so long. And I hate to beat that drum anymore, but there is something you posted on Twitter recently about valuation, suggesting that 25% of tech companies, based on the current valuation, is suggesting that they might grow at a compound annual growth rate of 15% every year for the next 15 years. You know, so when you see something like that, what do you take from that? I just have to start with you. What do you take from that?
Well, to a certain degree, the market is enamored with growth. And I think there's some reasons why that's reasonable, you know, because I think sometimes growth can cover up a multitude of sins, right? Take something like Google. You know, Google is still growing. I'm just going to pull it up right now. Google is still growing top line, probably over at or near high teens top line growth. And that's even $4 trillion plus company. And I think people say to themselves, okay, well, if you look out 5 years at this horizon point, if we feel confident in the durability of their moat and their competitive position, then we can really stand to believe that at this point in time, they're going to be this big. And that leaves a lot of room for valuations to compress given a certain growth rate. So looking out in the future, I think investors have become enamored with growth companies. Now, there's obviously a downside to this because the other side of the coin would say, well, a lot of these companies are being priced to perfection, and they're being priced that they're going to grow, you know, not only 15% per year, but a lot of these higher flying companies to grow substantially more than that into the far future. So it's, and I think the other thing, you know, people bring up interest rates a lot, but when the bulk of your cash flows are in the future, and that's the case in growth companies, right? Because they're longer duration assets, more earnings and sales are going to become in the future. You know, there's going to be a higher value placed on that when the time value of money has, you know, low interest rates like right now. So it's certainly an environment like that, but I really feel like in this environment, a lot of investors are gravitating towards growth covering up a multitude of sins is what I would describe it as.
Very interesting. Yeah, I hear you say that, and I'm not sure it was you, but recently on Twitter, I saw someone highlighting the fact that, I don't know what it was, 10 years ago today or something, the Palm Pilot, you know, was valued more than Apple and Google combined, something ridiculous like that. And it's such an interesting wake-up call, you know, to say, yeah, you can project these things out 15 plus years in the future, but then you remember cutting-edge tech that, you know, as that was back then, and how things can change as drastically as they can.
No, you know, you're absolutely right. And I think if you look across a lot of the high flyers today, and I'm not gonna include mega cap when I say this, just because I think, you know, mega cap is really not valued, you know, nearly as high as some of the smaller, you know, small and mid cap high flyers. But they really do have a high hurdle to reach when not only meeting these thresholds but exceeding them. And I think an important thing for listeners to remember is you take a company like ServiceNow, which is a, you know, prototypical SaaS company. They've just had extraordinary growth, but they started from such a lower multiple that, you know, they not only got the benefit of far exceeding sales estimates, revenue estimates, but, you know, they also got the benefit of multiple expansion. Whereas now on some of these, you know, you're starting from a very full price to sales or price to EBITDA multiple 5 years out, that it's not saying that you can't win, but the bar to having whatever IRR you're wanting, you're underwriting for, is a lot higher than before. So I think that's where the margin for error is significantly less than it was 5 years ago in these spaces.
How are you thinking about allocation, and how much are you factoring things like alternative assets or even emerging markets? I'd love to talk about both.
Well, I think alternatives, just for our particular firm, we do utilize alternative assets. Primarily, what we use alternatives for is to add non-correlated or less correlated return streams to traditional assets. So for instance, if we added, and I won't name names, but if we added certain, for example, a multi-strategy fund that was, you know, historically been non-correlated with stocks and bonds, you know, it might produce, you know, more steady stream, better risk-adjusted stream going out into the future. So, you know, pretty much, you know, the vast majority of our alternatives are not to shoot for, you know, market beating returns, but really I kind of refer to it as smoothing the path out. You know, you can try to optimize for path of assets or portfolios and try to optimize for destination, but you can't really do both. So I'd say a lot of the alternatives that we're including into portfolios are really to smooth out the path, you know, to limit downside and to provide a better, you know, risk-adjusted return for the overall portfolio. Now, whether or not these alternatives end up providing that, obviously one can debate, but really the goal is to, you know, to add some return streams which are less correlated to traditional stocks and bonds.
Right. I know there's a Ray Dalio quote about the holy grail of investing is something like 15 uncorrelated bets, as you're kind of alluding to. And there's also a wide range of alternatives. So I'm wondering if you could give us maybe one example of an alternative that you found maybe recently appealing.
I won't talk specific funds, but I'll highlight some examples. For instance, in the fixed income arbitrage space, this would be an example of a non-directional fund, meaning that if they're investing in credit and interest rates, in the case of interest rates, they're not betting on whether interest rates are going to go down or up. And in the case of credit, they're not necessarily betting on credit spreads going to contract or widen or vice versa. But, you know, one example of a trade might be betting on the mortgage basis. So, for instance, you know, you might be betting or investing such that mortgage spreads would tighten. So you might be long, they call it long the mortgage basis, and that, you know, you'd be long agency mortgages and short the risk-free treasuries against it. Or there might be treasury ARP where, you know, you might be buying a 9.5-year treasury and selling a 10-year treasury. So basically trying to find little inefficiencies and arbitrages in the market in which you can exploit. And theoretically, those would not be tied to, for instance, the direction of the S&P 500 or the direction of the Barclays Ag, but would have a different profile towards that.
That's fascinating. I'm wondering how much you might be thinking about emerging markets at a time like this. Is there anything outside of the U.S. that's appealing to you at the moment?
From time to time, we'll look at that. I think that there's a lot of idiosyncratic risk to those segments, and obviously driven a lot by FX and, you know, how those currencies do against the dollar, depending on which type of emerging assets. So from time to time, potentially for tactical positions, but I wouldn't say that we're investing substantially in emerging markets. But that doesn't mean that, you know, our position is, you know, that's just my personal preference, but doesn't mean that can't change. You know, maybe in our eyes, you know, they become very attractive in 6 months or vice versa.
Given your personal preference or your experience, which seems heavily weighted in the credit space, how are you thinking about bonds? I know it's a generalized question, but how do you think about bonds at a time like this with interest rates as low as they are?
I think a lot of investors and maybe casual observers kind of ooh and ah over that. But I think that there's a couple of things at play. You know, one is that there's a lot of forced buyers of these assets, whether it's sovereign wealth funds or, you know, central banks or banks, or there's a lot of forced buyers of this type of paper. You know, the other thing is obviously demographically, you know, there's a lot of studies that point to demographics being, you know, a major driver, lower not only nominal, but real yield in developed markets. So that's certainly, and that's not a new trend. I mean, that's a 30 plus year trend, but obviously the implications for where risk-free assets trade impact everything else. You know, there's no question that how risk-free trade, you know, impacts other things. And clearly central banks have become buyers and, you know, which has added a different dynamic. So it's one of those things I think used to be a source of income for clients and institutions, and really, you know, I think gone are those days. I think a lot of retirees used to look forward to the ability to buy munis at 4% tax-free yields, and that's not a factor anymore. I don't think that means that bonds are completely useless. And I think if you think about treasuries, particularly the long end of the curve, long treasuries traditionally have been one of the few places that have provided really risk-off exposure. So when things get really bad, so it's interesting, you go back to March 2020, so when things are kind of bad, for instance, investment-grade credit, investment-grade munis might get a bid, but then if they get really, really bad, well, then investors want to dump those too. So it's kind of this funny thing where if the markets get bad enough, things that are perceived as safe, munis, investment-grade corporates, those asset classes, which are originally a flight to safety, end up becoming dumped. So that leaves the depths of last March, treasuries with positive convexity are one of the few things that can really provide diversification and performance when times are really bad. So I think from that perspective, you can't completely throw away the space as an asset class because, there's certainly, benefits to those in adverse market environments.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4x points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The Investors Podcast Network is launching something new that hasn't been offered in years. It was very popular when we offered it years ago, and we're bringing it back again. We've launched a new stock investing course that dives deep into the first principles of sound investment strategies and explores a variety of relevant investing topics, ranging from the fundamental differences between active and passive investors, how to build and monitor a stock portfolio, tips for optimizing your retirement savings, and much more. For a limited time, all We Study Billionaires listeners get 15% off with the code WSB15 when you visit theinvestorspodcast.com/stock course. That's code WSB15 at theinvestorspodcast.com/stock course, or simply click the link in the show notes for this episode.
All right, back to the show.
Now, I'm kind of curious about the negative yielding debt in the world. It's turned around a little bit. There was about $18 trillion back in December, whereas now it's something like $12 trillion. But we're still talking about $12 trillion in negative yield. So not to say you're invested in that, I'm just kind of curious what your take on that is. What would be the desire to go into something like that?
An individual might be able to, metaphorically speaking, keep cash under their mattress, but larger institutions might be required to have certain positions in certain quantities. So, whether that's commercial banks or others, they're kind of forced into holding that. And, I think the Fed is clearly, we're not in a position where I think we've had to entertain really going, they call it negative nominal rates. Could that, happen in the future? I don't think it will, but clearly we've seen it in the developed world and you know, other G6 countries, and certainly a fascinating thing to look at.
Well, we're certainly in negative real rate territory at the moment, and a lot of that is due to some of the risks we've highlighted with the supply chain issues and the inflation involved. What is the biggest risk for the market right now, in your opinion?
The biggest risk, probably something that we're not thinking about or looking at right now. I mean, you know, traditionally, typically, there's things that come up every year, oftentimes multiple times a year. So are we going to get another drawdown? Sure. Is it going to be now, or is it going to be 10% higher from here? You know, nobody knows. But I think a lot of the kind of obvious ones would be, you know, would corporate tax rates go up? You know, that's certainly, you know, something that could happen and become a headwind. Could there be, you know, some other strain of COVID? You know, I think the market's kind of brushed that off to a large degree with the Delta variant, but obviously things could happen. But typically it's probably an unknown factor that's driving things. And markets are never about absolute numbers, but all about, from a relative perspective, what's going to happen relative to what the market's expecting. So we might still have a recovery and things might still be going good from a earnings perspective or whatever, but maybe relative to what everybody's thinking, you know, it comes in short due to X, Y, or Z. So that, you know, might be a kind of a cop-out answer, but most likely it's going to be something that we're not thinking about at the moment.
No, I like it. You did mention demographics earlier, and what came to my mind was something I read recently about possibly running out of Social Security money in 12 years and things like that, which to me just implies more printing, more devaluing of our dollar and possibly risking our position in the world, at least our credit worthiness. Is that of any concern in your eyes?
I think absolutely. Do we make capital market assumptions? Yes. I think that, you know, with the United States being a currency issuer, our big constraint on borrowing is really, you know, inflation. And that gets a whole another rabbit hole of what inflation is. Get a guess that's far brighter on that topic than I am. But yeah, I think from that perspective, certainly certain market proponents believe that we have a lot of capacity to borrow more to spur demand. You know, I think others believe that, you know, we can't just run up the deficits that we are without there being some kind of, you know, longer term implications, and that there could be unknown consequences of the types of stimulus programs that we're doing. But I think the answer is we're certainly going to be looking at all the inflation and demographic situations and fiscal environments, and I think all those things are very important when making investment decisions, but I think it's also important not to let my personal opinions on what's happening with the Fed or the Congress or whatever skew my thinking in terms of, because, you know, think about it, we can't control. I was just talking about this with somebody on Twitter. No matter what we think, whether we think policy is the best or the worst or in between, we can't control that to a large degree. We can vote, we should, but we can't control things after that. So, you know, from an investor's perspective, an allocator or active managers, you know, it's our responsibility to invest in the environment that we have. So back to your original question, certainly, you know, those are things that we think about, but whether or not they're going to impact today or the near term or the medium term is more the issue.
I like that. And it obviously harkens back to, you know, investing from the ground up. So I'm curious, if you had, let's call it three businesses that you could invest in over the next, say, 5 to 10 years, which companies, in your opinion, are best suited to kind of endure whatever might be coming over that time frame and outperform?
I'll give a couple of ideas. The first caveat being that we do own positions in these securities, some are for our firm and myself personally. But I think, you know, one company that I like a lot, and I'll talk business wise, you know, which businesses do I think, you know, are going to do well? You know, whether or not, so I'll hedge a little bit, you know, whether or not the stocks actually do well. kind of early to tell, but one of them is a payments company called Adyen. So Adyen's a Netherlands-based payment company. And so basically what they do is they offer a single payments platform to accept payments anywhere on any device, whether that's e-commerce or in person. And yeah, the interesting thing about Adyen, and most people haven't heard of them, maybe more so in the last year or so, but really they were built from the ground up in 2006. And the reason that the founders did this is because the way that things were set up before, it was kind of a hodgepodge of different systems that were built on old infrastructure. And so, you know, a lot of these old payments companies kept acquiring, bolted on, cut costs, and really the underlying technology wasn't really that good. And so I think Adyen, the one platform anywhere, you know, whether it's, you know, whether you're in the US or Brazil, whether you're online or in person, you know, this has really been a great business. And, you know, a lot of their growth has been in large enterprises. So if you think eBay, Spotify, Uber, Etsy, you know, last quarter, I think they won Louis Vuitton. You know, and this is a business that I think can really grow revenue by probably 30% per year for the next decade, really. And not only that, but their EBITDA margins are in the mid-60s. So they're insanely profitable. Optically, the company's expensive, but I think, you know, these trends of kind of unified, you know, and omni-commerce, meaning, you know, maybe you order online and then you can return it to the store, or maybe you go into a shoe store and they don't have it in store, but then you can buy it in store and ship it home. This omni-commerce is becoming more and more part of the way that the world is working, especially post-COVID and a e-commerce boom. And I think Adyen is really positioned at a lot of super, super important secular growth trends. And, you know, I think the bet, because obviously, you know, you're paying a little bit of a higher multiple for this growth. But I think, you know, the bet is that with a lot of great companies over time, I think investors can focus too much on the stated valuation and not as much on the optionality that those companies have. So great, fast-growing companies historically have had other sources of revenue and profits that emerge. So for instance, if you went back, you know, I'm not comparing Adyen to Amazon, but, you know, the way that a lot of people look at popular growth companies that really have durable growth profiles is they kind of underprice that optionality. And so I think my belief is that a company that's growing like this and has such great loyalty and basically, you know, less than 1% churn, so much revenue growth coming from existing clients, is that they are going to find new sources of revenue. So I believe in the top line growth of their core business, but I think that there's other things that are going to come about, whether that's issuance of cards or whatever, that, you know, they're going to drive this company into the future. So I think that's certainly one that I like a lot for the future. And obviously, caveat being that, you know, that we have owned this company for some time.
What's your takeaway on the competitive moat exactly? You know, what's going to stop another payment company to kind of infiltrate their space, given that they're kind of somewhat regional today?
Regional based there, but, you know, as far as their growth, you know, they've been growing all over the world. But I think their technology, because of their technology, they have less fraud, less, you know, losses and things like that. And I think that their ability to adapt to the environment compared to a lot of these legacy players. And I think that's one of the big things. The legacy players are so stale and unable to innovate that, you know, not only with the e-commerce growth going forward, but the existing share that I think they can take from these legacy guys, that I think is really underappreciated. I think the second one I'll say, and it'll be more boring, but I don't think it's any less, you know, important is Google. You know, I think, you know, I could highlight Google or Amazon because I like them both. But I mean, if you think about Google, obviously you have your core business with their ad revenue, which is still growing. But I think, you know, one of the booming things has become YouTube, and just the, you know, YouTube think about an amazing story, right? You know, YouTube being purchased for, I think it was $1 billion, and don't quote me, I'm close, I'm probably within 500 million, but I mean, it was a heavily scrutinized acquisition at the time. And the interesting thing is people didn't even know how they were going to make money. So a lot of people thought it was going to be on the TV aspect. And if you think about how amazing of a business YouTube is, you have people creating YouTube's own content, right? You know, so they're the content creators of this, and the flywheel effect of, you know, more content drawing, you know, more viewers and more ads. And so that business, I think, is just such an amazing company. And I think up until probably the last year or so, it's really been underappreciated because it's been kind of hiding under the Google umbrella, but that's become big. And then I think, you know, after that, to a similar degree, you know, Google Cloud is growing pretty substantially. And it's certainly, no question, it's a distant third to AWS and Azure, but there's limited players to be a cloud provider in the world right now. I think you have to have substantial capital to do that. And I think that they are going to, you know, even if they're not a big, even if they don't displace AWS or Azure, you know, I think it can be, still be a great business over time, even as the number three player in the US. But not only that, just the amount of free cash flow that they're generating. Last 12 months as of 6/30, you know, it looks like close to $60 billion of free cash flow. And so not only does that give them flexibility for, you know, acquisitions, which I think, you know, they've been pretty conservative on, but also buyback. You know, they've started to really pull the buyback lever. And I think that they've been a lot more conservative on that than, you know, at least, you know, next to somebody like Apple, you know, which has utilized it a lot more. And I think that that's going to become a bigger and bigger thing. But it's hard to believe that a company like Google is still, they do over, you know, $210 billion of revenue for 2021, but they're still growing in the mid-to-high teens. I mean, it's just really remarkable. So I think that, you know, it's a reasonable valuation going forward. And you've got, quite a few engines underneath their core business that are going to grow. And I think as you look out a couple of years, not that many years, if you look out a couple of years with Google's growth, I mean, they've certainly re-rated in the last year, but it's very reasonable compared to a lot of companies in the S&P that are trading in the low 20s PE right now with revenue growth that inflation or just a little bit higher than inflation. I think you can get Google for similar multiple, a little bit higher multiple, but on a forward basis, you know, significantly cheaper. So I think that there is some safety in the growth as far as mega cap tech goes. So, you know, what happens with the regulatory environment? I don't know. You know, will something happen to some of these? Probably. Will it be punitive to the stock? My guess, probably not, in that it's probably going to take a long time. And, you know, at that point in time, you know, these companies might be a lot larger than they are now, and potentially the pieces might be sold for more than, you know, the sum of the parts. So, you know, that's another thing to think about. But, you know, certainly at least the headline, that could be a headwind.
Well, David, this was so much fun. Thank you for sharing a few of those ideas. I think they're super interesting. And this was a very holistic discussion on markets, on companies, on a whole number of things. And so I know our audience is going to glean a lot of insight from it. I really hope we can do this again sometime soon. And I'm going to continue to follow you on Twitter and enjoy your commentary. And I hope we get to do it another time.
Likewise, Trey. Thank you for having me on, and I look forward to it.
All right, you beautiful people. If you're loving the show, please don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast app so you get these episodes in the app automatically. The guest today and I originally connected on Twitter, so if you want to reach out, you can always grab me at Trey Lockerbie. And lastly, if you're trying to learn the intrinsic value of a company, look no further than the TIP Finance tool. Just simply Google TIP Finance and it should pop right up. And with that, we'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network and learn how to achieve financial independence. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, Go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.